This episode of Morbidology is sponsored by Yarn, an interactive storytelling app where stories are told as text messages between the main characters. It offers everything from true crime chat fiction stories to even choosing your own adventure. They have series such as Mystery Dog and Haunted Camper, but my favourite has got to be their latest podcast, Strange Street, where you follow the main character, Cece, into a mysterious alternate universe. It had me guessing the entire time. So if you love true crime podcasts, then Yarn is the app for you. Tap through the most addictive and immersive stories today, only on Yarn. Trust me, with over 27 million downloads, Yarn is a must play. Download Yarn for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Y-A-R-N. Download it today to watch, read, and listen to all of your favourite fiction stories. From steamy to horror, Yarn has it all. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. A collective fear that many women face is walking alone at nighttime. Most women can relate to the sense of terror that washes over when you think that somebody could be following you or watching you. In Columbus, Ohio, in 2007, a young woman vanished while walking to her parked car after finishing her shift at a local bar. The investigation would reveal many systemic failures in Ohio's justice system and lead to a change in law. It would also give legitimacy to the collective fear of walking alone at night. Reagan Toks was a fourth-year clinical psychology student at Ohio State University. She was well known to the customers at Bodega, where she worked, because of her happy and friendly demeanour. Al Woodson, who lived above Bodega, said, "She was a loving, awesome, amazing person." Her parents described her as an ambitious and kind woman, who was dedicated to her family and church. She was heavily involved in mission trips at the local Methodist church, and was a four-year varsity tennis player at Anthony Wayne. She loved animals and being outside in nature. In 2017, Reagan was preparing to graduate. She hoped that when she graduated, she would move to Cleveland and work for the Cleveland Clinic. On the 8th of February 2017, Reagan started her shift at Bodega, a popular bar located in the Short North. When Reagan didn't arrive back home to her off-campus apartment that night, her roommate, Kristen Hall, didn't notice until the following morning, when she noticed that Reagan hadn't slept in her bed. Fear washed over. She texted Reagan to see if she had gotten home safely and whether she had gone to class that morning without her. When Reagan didn't reply, Kristen placed a phone call to Reagan's sister, Mackenzie Toks, who said that she hadn't heard from her sister either. They called Bodega and were informed that Reagan had finished her shift the night before at around 8:30 p.m, but then stayed to have dinner at the bar. She left alone at around 9:45 p.m. Bodega employees typically parked on the streets behind the bar, where they were able to park for free, but the area is not well lit. A colleague said that Reagan often had a bartender walk her to her car, but this night, she didn't. Upon learning this, Mackenzie reported her sister missing to Columbus police. Mackenzie said that her sister was very responsible and it wasn't like her just to not come home and to not inform somebody if she was going out. Two of Reagan's roommates said that she texted them at 9:20 p.m. and this was the last contact they had with her. Mackenzie had texted her sister at 10:30 p.m. and the message was delivered. She informed police that her sister's car was also missing. She drove a 1999 Acura with a Miami Dolphins sticker, as well as an Ohio State University sticker. As police began their search for Reagan, Mackenzie posted on social media, asking for people to keep an eye out for Reagan and contact police if anyone knew anything about her whereabouts. Reagan's friends and family called around all of her friends to see if anybody had seen her and searched the streets for her car, but to no avail. They even called around local hospitals and jails, but they were unsuccessful in locating her. The following day, there was a grim update in the case when it was announced that a woman's body had been discovered at Scioto Grove Metro Park in Grove Park at around 1 p.m. A man driving into the park called police to report that he had found a woman's body in a field approximately 15 feet from the road at the entrance to the park. While it wasn't announced that the woman was Reagan or how the woman had died, rumours began to circulate that the woman found had a circle tattoo on her side. Emma Steele, a friend of Reagan, said that Reagan had a circle tattoo on her side. At 8 p.m, Grove City police officers went to Reagan's apartment and asked her roommates to match the woman's tattoo with Reagan's tattoo. When they saw the photograph, they knew immediately that it was Reagan. The following day, the Franklin County coroner confirmed that the body was that of Reagan and that she had been shot twice in the head. There were no shell casings found at the scene, which led investigators to speculate that she had been killed elsewhere. In a cruel twist of fate, Mackenzie would reveal that she had learned of her sister's death through social media. In the digital age, sometimes the media and police can move at varying speeds. Reagan's car would be found abandoned on the 700 block of Oakwood Avenue, on the southern side of Columbus, around 4 miles from Bodega. Following the identification, Ohio State University released a statement which read, "We are deeply troubled by the death of Reagan Tokes, a fourth-year psychology student. We extend our deepest sympathy to her family and friends." They further announced that counselling and consultation services were going to be available for those who needed support. Reagan's parents lived in Parkland, Florida, and had moved there around 4 years earlier. After Reagan was identified, her father, Toby, spoke with the Blade and said, "I knew before I found out. I can only tell you, it's parents' intuition. It's a complete tragedy. She was taken from us." Almost 50 friends, family, and acquaintances packed into the United Methodist Church for a vigil. Reverend Joni Schilling said that they were all shocked by the murder, but said that there was strength in the love that they all shared. She said, "I think it's awesome that you are here to support each other, but also that you have trust in God." She said that some people in attendance may feel anger or have doubt in God, adding that God is okay with that, and that they could get through the tragedy with the power God provides them. The murder stunned the college community and left many women afraid to be walking anywhere alone, especially at night. Brianna Sowers, who was also a psychology student, said that she often closed up late at night at the bar where she worked, but always made sure that one of her co-workers was with her. Now, she was even more afraid. Nikki Moore, who also worked in the restaurant industry, said, "It feels like it just hits really close to home. I think it goes to show, no matter how comfortable you feel, you always need to be prepared, because at the end of the day, we don't know who's outside those doors. The parking in Short North was very scarce, and many employees in the area had to walk a distance to get back to their cars at night. The area wasn't well lit. Ohio State University issued a neighborhood safety notice and asked people with tips to please come forward, or if anybody noticed anything suspicious, to contact police. The notice asked students to increase their overall safety by remaining cautious and looking out for each other, by walking with somebody else and utilizing transportation services. It made people feel even more uncomfortable when investigators announced that they had no suspects in the case. However, the uneasy feeling that a killer was lurking in the midst wouldn't last long. On the 11th of February, 29-year-old Brian Goldsby was arrested and charged with aggravated murder, kidnapping, and aggravated robbery. He had been identified as a suspect through DNA evidence that was collected in and around Reagan's car. Her car had been discovered near where Brian was living in Columbus. Investigators announced that they believed that Reagan encountered Brian shortly after she left Bodega. They further announced the charges against Brian were based on statements that he gave them. However, when asked if he had confessed, an investigator said, "He gave us details of these events of that night that closely match what we're finding." At the time of his arrest, Brian was a registered sex offender who had pleaded guilty to aggravated robbery and attempted rape charges in May of 2011. Following Brian's arrest, a moment of silence was held in Reagan's honour, a bodega. The music stopped, and while the bar was packed with patrons, there was nothing but silence. Many people held candles as a tribute to Reagan, while others brought along flowers, which filled the front windows. Following the silence, patrons spoke about Reagan and what had happened. A senior named Vera said, "I'm still in shock. She was a nice person and very friendly. She did not deserve this." It would be revealed that Brian had admitted to abducting Reagan in the area of North High Street and 3rd Avenue in the Short North after she left her shift. Brian told investigators that he took her car and they drove to a Chase Bank ATM on South High Street. Brian forced Reagan to withdraw $60. During the interrogation, Brian initially claimed that he hadn't raped or murdered Reagan, claiming that he left her naked at Scioto Grove Metro Park. Brian's DNA was recovered from a cigarette butt which was found inside Reagan's car. During his interview with investigators, Brian had first of all claimed no involvement in the murder before being presented with the evidence that his DNA was at the crime scene. He then admitted that he drove Reagan to Scioto Grove Metro Park, where he had raped her and then shot her twice in the head. Following the update, Brian received an additional charge of rape. Franklin County prosecutor Ron O'Brien subsequently announced that he was considering seeking the death penalty against Brian, and he was ordered to be held without bond. As it would turn out, Brian had quite an extensive criminal history, which started when he was just a teenager. When Brian was 13 years old, he was found to be an unruly minor beyond the reasonable control of his parent. Shortly thereafter, he was charged with a delinquency count of petty theft for shoplifting. When he was 14 years old, he threatened his mother with a knife and told her that she better not mess with him after she confronted him about breaking the lock off her bedroom door and stealing cigarettes and tapes. The juvenile court would remove Brian from his mother's care and place him into the custody of Franklin County Children's Services, which placed him in foster care. He spent time at Buckeye Ranch in Grove City and in a boot camp for juvenile offenders. When Brian was 17 years old, he was committed to the Ohio Department of Youth Services for a maximum of 6 months after he was found delinquent for receiving stolen property. As part of his sentence, he was ordered to undergo a sex offender assessment. When he was 22 years old, he was accused of raping a woman at knife point in front of her 2-year-old son. He was charged with robbing a woman 2 weeks later. He threatened the second woman by stating that he had a gun under his shirt. The following year, he pleaded guilty to attempted rape and robbery in a plea agreement. He served 6 years before being released in the November before Reagan was killed. There had been a spate of violent robberies of women in German Village, and investigators were interviewing some of the victims to try and determine whether Brian could have been responsible. According to state officials, there was no indication that Brian had violated terms of his release. He had been required to have 3 face-to-face meetings with parole officers each month. He had a job and was staying at a community house for offenders re-entering society who would otherwise be homeless. Joellen Smith, a spokeswoman for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, said, "All contact standards were made during his brief period of supervision." Shortly thereafter, however, it would be revealed that Brian had special conditions on his prison release for 5 years. This meant that Brian was on GPS monitoring at the time of Reagan's murder. A spokesperson for the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction said that the level of monitoring for the offender depended on the offender and circumstances for which the service is required, but refused to elaborate any further. In the wake of Reagan's murder, a GoFundMe page was set up in her memory to raise funds for a scholarship which would give another hardworking high school student a chance to attend the college of their dreams, just like Reagan did. Bodega said that on the Sunday, all of the proceeds from their sales would be donated to the scholarship fund. Within days, the fund swelled to more than $75,000. In Reagan's honour, an anonymous donor also offered to pay for 50 women to take a self-defence class at a local gym. On the 14th of February, Reagan was laid to rest. Friends and family gathered at the United Methodist Church for what was described as a celebration of life. Reagan's family said that her Christian faith taught her to have a passion for those less fortunate, and asked mourners to focus on the positive and not the negative, to remember the vibrant person that they knew, and not the violent way her life had ended. Her family would release a statement expressing gratitude for the community, as well as law enforcement. It read in part, "The kindness and compassion from friends and family is immeasurable, and the support from those who do not even know us is unbelievable. Our daughter blessed our lives as a kind, vibrant, loving soul, but to hear all the wonderful stories of those lives she blessed in addition to ours is a true gift. It has helped more than words can say as we struggle with our crushing grief." They further stated that the system which led to Reagan's death was flawed and that changes needed and would happen as a result of Reagan's death. Reagan was subsequently buried at Fort Meigs Cemetery. Just the day after Reagan's funeral, it was revealed that data from Brian's GPS monitor placed him at the scene where Reagan's body was discovered. Investigators announced that they would be reviewing the GPS monitoring data to try and determine whether Brian could have been responsible for a series of attacks and robberies in the German Village area. Furthermore, a number of victims of other incidents had come forward after Brian was arrested, with the belief that he was the man who assaulted them or robbed them. There had been a spate of attacks in the German Village area, and each attack was different. In one, the attacker punched a woman, while in others, a knife or gun was shown. After it was revealed that Brian had been wearing a GPS monitor, many people questioned how he was able to commit the murder. However, this had come from a misunderstanding of how GPS monitors are used to track parolees. GPS monitors aren't used to prevent crimes, but instead to track criminals. In Brian's case, it was because he didn't yet have a permanent address and had been living in a halfway house. It was also used to ensure that Brian didn't leave the area and would report to his parole officer. Quite often, violations aren't even discovered until the next day, or even days later when authorities review the reports on the GPS tracker. There's often a misbelief that somebody is watching a parolee's GPS monitor 24/7, but that just isn't the case and would be far too expensive for most government budgets. The following month, it was announced that Brian had 3 parole violations, following his release from prison in November. He had been sanctioned by parole officers for failing to comply with rules at the Alvis House Reentry Programme, for failing to reside in an approved residence, and also for failing to keep his GPS monitor charged. Towards the end of March, Brian appeared in court, where he was formally indicted on charges of aggravated murder, aggravated robbery, kidnapping, rape, and tampering with evidence. For the aggravated murder charge, Brian faced other specifications of premeditated, kidnapping, aggravated robbery, rape, murder to avoid detection, and firearm specifications. Additional indictments for aggravated robbery and kidnapping related to the earlier attacks in German Village. These attacks had spanned over several weeks before Reagan's death, and Brian's GPS monitor indicated that he had very likely been the perpetrator. On the 23rd of January, a 68-year-old woman had been punched in the face as she got out of her car. The following day, a man approached a woman, held a knife to her throat, and demanded money. On the 27th of January, a woman was robbed at knife point. On the 1st of February, a man was kidnapped and robbed at gunpoint. The following day, another man was kidnapped and robbed at gunpoint. On the 6th of February, a woman was robbed at gunpoint. The following day, another woman was robbed at gunpoint, and then the day after that, Reagan was murdered. Franklin County Prosecutor Rob O'Brien said that they believed that Reagan had been randomly targeted by Brian. His GPS monitor showed that on the night of Reagan's murder, he had been out in the area that night. He stated, "Unfortunately, Reagan Tokes was walking down 3rd Avenue and was a random victim. We coordinated our GPS and it appeared to be that he was trolling the entire neighbourhood looking for someone like her that was alone that he could prey upon." He said that Reagan was with Brian for almost 3 hours and they believed that she was killed at the park where her body was discovered, but he refused to reveal where they believed that Reagan had been raped. They had determined that she wasn't raped in the park where she was found, because Brian was only there for several minutes. He further revealed that Brian would be facing the death penalty. Brian would plead not guilty to all of the charges. In May, Reagan's parents were awarded her diploma from the Ohio State University. Reagan was just 3 months from graduating with a psychology degree when she was killed. They wrote an open letter which read in part, "Today, Reagan's dream became a reality, as she was awarded a diploma from the Ohio State University. It is heartbreaking that she was not able to accept the diploma herself, but we are so grateful to the university for presenting it to us." They urged her fellow graduates to use their gifts to make the world a better place, like Reagan had wanted to do. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counsellor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn has sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships. Both Podcorn, indie podcasts like Morbidology, are able to work with amazing brands on their podcast and earn some cash for their work. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast or finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for your podcast or advertise your brand. All you need to do is sign up for free and begin browsing Podcorn's marketplace. The marketplace is super easy to use and has a handy calendar to take the stress out of booking multiple sponsors. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today. As the defense and prosecution were preparing to go to trial, it was revealed that in the hours that Brian abducted, raped, and murdered Reagan, he had called his housing project to say that he was on his way home from work and would be late. He had called the night monitor at Nothing Into Something Real Estate Incorporated and was told by the night monitor that he would need to verify his work schedule with the monitors because of the length of time it took him to return home that night. When Brian was linked to the other spate of attacks, a lot of people were left questioning how his GPS monitor hadn't linked him to the crimes earlier. Two Ohio legislators started to ask questions whether GPS monitors were effective and whether they provided a false sense of security in Ohio. Ohio State Representatives Kristen Boggs and David Leland accused the Ohio Department of Rehabilitations and Corrections of not keeping a close eye on Brian. It would be revealed that there were no exclusionary zones put on Brian's monitor, which meant that he could go where he wanted. State Representative Boggs said, "Essentially, he had this monitor on with the false assumption that someone is going to be monitoring his whereabouts, and nobody was." The following month, State Representative Boggs announced that she was wanting legislators to consider changing Ohio sentencing laws. She highlighted a problem in the state's truth in sentencing law, which went back to 1996. This law required definitive prison terms that took away any flexibility when it came to dealing with people who were extreme cases. They said that when somebody is incarcerated, if they show behaviour that indicates that they will be a danger once released, then DCR should be given the opportunity to notice the judge, and then the judge decide on how to handle the situation. State Representative Boggs said that she was working on a legislative proposal to change that. She further stated that she believed the state needed to develop a publicly run re-entry housing and programming for violent felons, GPS monitoring which clearly defined zones and times and more parole officers. Brian's lawyer would file a motion to have the murder trial moved to a different county, but Franklin County Judge David Serrett rejected the request. He said that he would revisit it when it was time to question jurors, but right now he believed that Brian could get a fair trial, and it wasn't necessary for the trial to be moved. It was then announced that a legislation known as the Reagan-Tokes Act was being put forward. Under the initial proposal, violent felons would be sentenced to an indeterminate sentence with a minimum and maximum. The bill would also require that when a violent and potentially dangerous felon is released from prison and are rejected for programs easing re-entry into society, that the state create and recommend a re-entry program so that the felon is not left homeless. When Brian was released from prison in the November, he had been rejected by private re-entry programs. The bill would also require that each felon fitted with a GPS monitor would have an inclusionary restriction, and it would also give law enforcement real-time access to GPS information without needing a subpoena. When the legislation was introduced towards the end of September, Reagan's parents, Lisa and Toby, spoke together publicly for the first time. They said that they had been working closely with lawmakers for months and said, "It's just devastating as parents. You never get over it. It's always there. It's always with you. What was taken from us? Something positive had to come from it. God finds ways to do good in all things, evil things." They said that with the legislation, they hoped that something positive could come out of the tragedy. In November, Brian's defense team asked for the murder trial to be delayed, pending the resolution of House Bill 389, which was a bill seeking to abolish the death penalty in Ohio. As they were working to get the trial pushed back, in another court, concerns were raised about how expensive the Reagan-Tokes Act would be. The American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio testified that there hadn't been enough discussion on the potential costs of implementing sentencing and parole reforms. Gary Daniels, who was the chief lobbyist for ACLU Ohio, told the House Criminal Justice Committee that they did not oppose of the bill, but raised concerns about how much it would cost to hire more parole officers, create more temporary housing for released inmates, ensuring that there is enough GPS monitoring devices to go around, and building a new database at the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. As Christmas was fast approaching, it was announced that Common Pleas Judge Mark Serrett rejected the request by Brian's defense attorneys to dismiss the death penalty. Brian was ordered to stand trial in March of 2018. Before the trial began, Brian was in court where the GPS monitoring evidence was discussed. The prosecution brought in an expert from Florida who testified about the accuracy of GPS monitoring, stating that it is so reliable that even the military and commercial planes use it to land. Brian's defense team were wanting to have the evidence excluded for trial, but the prosecution were arguing that it was relevant to the case. The judge would decide that the GPS monitoring could be entered as evidence and presented during trial. The trial began in March. During opening statements, Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien announced some of the evidence that they had against Brian. He said that there was a cigarette butt with Brian's DNA left in the back seat of Reagan's car. Gunpowder had been found on Brian's sleeve as well as in Reagan's wounds. Brian's semen had also been found inside Reagan. Furthermore, they had a video recording of Reagan's car, as she was forced to withdraw cash in several banks. They believed that the footage showed Brian in her car, while other footage showed Reagan filling her car at a Safeway, while Brian kept watch. He briefly spoke about the GPS monitoring, stating,
"That actually tracked him each and every step of that night of terror for Reagan Tokes."
Prosecutor O'Brien went on to say that Brian had lied about his involvement numerous times, before admitting, progressively, as much as he knew, that the investigators on the case could prove. He said that evidence would show that Brian dumped the murder weapon in a sewer in South Linden, near where he lived, and even directed investigators to it. He also said that Brian had stolen Reagan's Kate Spade purse and $60 in cash, which he gave to the mother of his child. He also tried, but failed, to set Reagan's car on fire. During opening statements, defense attorney Court Gatterdam told the jury that they would need to critically analyze all of the evidence, stating, "Does the video answer questions or raise more questions?" As he noted that Reagan got out of the car to pump the gas, he said,
"The state indicated it will present DNA evidence. DNA does not tell you the how, the why, or the when. When all the evidence is in, we will stand back up and explain what charges and elements within those charges we think the state did not prove. You will see that Mr. Goolsbee did not tell the complete truth in his interrogation with the officers. Few suspects do. But he's not on trial for not telling a complete statement."
Defense Gatterdam never actually claimed that his client was innocent, but said that he would be fighting to save his life. On the first morning of the trial, jurors clambered into a bus as they were driven to the scenes of fear and violence that unfolded for Reagan on the night of her murder. First, they visited a bodega before heading towards a stretch of East 3rd Avenue, just around the corner, where a man wearing a puffy white coat approached Reagan and forced her to drive with him in the car. They visited a bank where Reagan was forced to withdraw money, and another where a withdrawal was declined. They were then taken to the final place, a muddy field in Scioto Grove Metro Park, where Reagan was shot twice in the head. Here, there was a small cluster of crosses which marked the final moment of Reagan's life. The crime scene tour was followed by testimony from Richard Bonner, the man who discovered Reagan's body. He said that first of all, he thought that what he was looking at was a mannequin.
"I saw blood, dried blood, coming from her nostrils onto her face, and I knew that wasn't a mannequin."
His testimony was followed by testimony from Todd Fortner, a special investigator for the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation. He said that he believed that Reagan had been ordered to get out of the car naked and walk into the park at gunpoint. He said that a victim's hair or arms are typically above their head if they're dragged somewhere, and said that Reagan's arms were left at her side. This led him to believe that Reagan had been killed at the park where her body had been found. He said she actually walked through the dirt or mud to get there. She wasn't dragged there. Nick Deskins, a Grove City police detective, testified next. He said that license plate scanners had located Reagan's car outside 705 Oakwood Avenue. He said that the burns on the driver's seat looked as though somebody had tried to burn the car. There would also be testimony from Hattissa Jackson, the girlfriend of Brian. She told the jury that Brian had given her a Kate Spade purse, which would later be identified as belonging to Reagan. He had given it to her just hours after Reagan was murdered. It contained a wallet, lotion, and pepper spray. She said that Brian had also handed her $60, which was the same amount that Reagan had lifted that night.
"Is that the purse that Mr. Goolsbee gave you that early morning?"
"Yes, that's the purse."
"And did he tell you where he got it?"
"No."
She additionally testified that she had ridden in a car with Brian, which she later identified as Reagan's car. And she said that the car had smelled like gasoline. Following Hattissa's testimony, Tiwana Richards, a friend of Brian, testified. She said that on the day of Reagan's murder, Brian had warned her about a gun he had in his coat pocket.
I went to pick up the coat. It was heavy, and I knew it was heavy, so I was like, "What's in here?" And he said his gun was in there.
She said that she had been moving Brian's coat when she asked him why it was so heavy, and he replied that there was a gun inside his pocket. Then the following day, Brian visited her again, but this time he was driving a silver Acura, the type of car that Reagan had drove. He told her that he had just got it. According to Tiwana, this time, Brian's demeanor had changed. She said, "He looked pretty strange compared to normal days, like something was a little different." The jury would also listen to Brian's taped interview, during which he detailed Reagan's abduction and murder. Detective Richard Forney testified that during the interview, they had told Brian that they thought that he was a decent guy and that somebody else must have committed the murder. After initially denying that he had been involved in Reagan's murder, he later claimed that he had abducted and robbed Reagan before leaving her naked at Scioto Grove Metro Park, completely denying that he had raped or killed her.
What did he tell you at that point for the first couple hours?
First couple hours, he told us that he had taken Reagan into a car, had committed a robbery of her. He needed money. He took her to some ATMs, and then he said he left her naked in a field during a snowstorm.
However, he later changed his story and claimed that an accomplice had raped and shot Reagan. He claimed that it was an old high school friend named TJ who forced him to carjack Reagan, stating that he would hurt his family if he didn't comply. He claimed that TJ made him take Reagan to withdraw money from an ATM and then forced him to have sex with her in her car before shooting her as Brian allegedly watched on. During the interview, Brian said, "It was the first time in my life that I ever saw someone get killed. I don't know why he killed her." Detective Forney said that their investigation found that the man named TJ, with an alleged teardrop tattoo underneath his right eye and a cross on his forehead, did not exist. At one point in the video, Brian placed his hands in his head and asked the investigators what evidence they had against him. The evidence included the GPS monitoring evidence, and Detective Forney would next take the jury through it. Brian was in the 3rd Avenue area, where he admitted to abducting Reagan at some point between 9:42 p.m. and 9:45 p.m. At 9:45 p.m., he was moving at 20 kilometers per hour, which showed that he was in a vehicle. He stopped at a Chase Bank at 10:02 p.m. Then at 10:14 p.m., he was at Huntington Bank, where Reagan was photographed on CCTV. Then at 10:18 p.m., Brian was stationary in an alleyway for around 12 minutes, a time which prosecutors believe he was raping Reagan. Brian was then marked at 2 gas stations, and 9 minutes later, he was at Scioto Grove Metro Park for 4 minutes, which was where Reagan's body had been found. During Brian's interview, he had told detectives that after forcing Reagan into her own car, she said, "All I want to do is live." After the interview was played out, Jennifer Nicol, the mother of Brian's 6-year-old daughter, was called to the stand. She said that when she pressed Brian while at the county jail, he essentially confessed.
I said, "Did you rape Reagan?" He shook his head like this. I started to cry.
So indicating yes for the
yes.
record.
And I asked him if he killed her. He shook his head yes. I dropped the phone and I left the visit.
She said that when she visited him again later to try and find out why Brian had raped and murdered Reagan, she told the jury that his answer was that he wanted money. She said to him, "You have a job, you have money." She said that this was the last time she ever spoke to Brian. Brittany Stepp, who thought of Brian as a brother, testified that Brian had confessed to robbing, raping, and murdering Reagan to her as well.
He said, "I'm sorry, I got scared." I said, "Did you do it?" And he shook his head yes. I asked him why he did what he did. And I said, "Please don't tell me that you really did this." And that's when he admitted to me of doing what he did.
Tell us what he said.
He said that he kidnapped her, he robbed her, he raped her, and then he shot her at the park.
In addition to Brian's DNA being discovered on a cigarette butt inside Reagan's car and found inside Reagan, her DNA was discovered on the gun which Brian directed investigators to. The defense decided against calling any witnesses. Brian waived his right to testify. During closing arguments, Assistant Prosecutor Jennifer Roche described what happened to Reagan that night as every woman's nightmare. Defense attorney Diane Mensch said that Brian was guilty of aggravated murder with purpose. She then tried to turn the fact that he was wearing a GPS monitoring device into an advantage in challenging the intent he had to not get caught. She said, if Mr. Goolsbee didn't want to get caught, then he shouldn't have worn the GPS bracelet. For days, he wore the bracelet. Not only didn't he remove it, he charged it so that it would be really accurate. She suggested that the murder wasn't premeditated, but that Brian had panicked in the moment. The jury were sent away to deliberate, and after more than 5 hours, they reached a verdict. They found Brian Goolsbee guilty on 9 counts, including multiple counts of aggravated murder, aggravated robbery, kidnapping, rape, and tampering with evidence. The sentencing phase would follow. Brian was given the opportunity to speak.
Today I would like to apologize to the Tulks family for the crimes I committed against your daughter, friends, family. When I first got locked up, I lied about everything. Said it was a TJ. There is no TJ. TJ is not real. I made TJ up because I was trying to wiggle my way out of the crime that I committed. But the only other thing I have to say is, please have mercy on me.
He admitted that TJ was fabricated, stating, I made up TJ because I was trying to wiggle my way out of a crime that I had committed. His defense team said that they wanted the jury to know Brian as a person, a deeply troubled person, whose upbringing and neglect had part to play in his actions. They stated that Brian's mother was 17 years old when she gave birth to him. And shortly thereafter, Franklin County Children's Services opened a neglect case against her. Brian had been beaten by his mother as a young child, with electrical cords and ropes. She would strap phone books and other weights onto Brian's back, and made him repeatedly run up and down the stairs. Brian's father abandoned him and was never part of his life, while his mother Stephanie was addicted to alcohol and cocaine throughout his upbringing. She died before the trial when she was just 47 years old from complications of alcohol. Howard Fratkin, a psychologist and trauma specialist, testified that Brian had told him that when he was 12 years old, he was robbed, beaten, and raped at a neighbourhood carryout. According to the psychologist, the trauma that followed was extreme, and caused Brian to become more depressed and turn to crime. His testimony was followed by testimony from Bob Stinson, a forensic psychologist, who said that Brian was born into an extended family rooted in poverty, substance abuse, violence and mental impairments, which was a recipe for disaster. He went on to say that both hereditary and behavioural factors were stacked against Brian, stating that most of his relatives had multiple serious risk factors, including addictions, mental illness, domestic violence, and absent and abusive parents.
Brian reported the sexual abuse around the age of 12 or 13. It shows up in various records throughout his adolescence and even into his adulthood that he was the victim of sexual abuse.
And when you say sexual abuse, what was reported between the ages of 12 and 13?
So in this case, there was a man who apparently attempted to rob Brian and wanted everything he had. Brian really had nothing to give this man. This man took Brian behind a store and then anally raped Brian and forced Brian to perform fellatio or oral sex on the man.
Let's turn now to Brian's mother.
So I mentioned earlier that when I talk about Brian's mother having been abusive, I'm not talking about somebody who, you know, slapped a little too hard, spanked a little too hard, you know, flew off the handle one time. I'm talking about someone who used a belt, an electrical cord on Brian, leaving welts, to the point that when he was 5 years old, he's taken to the hospital. She's charged criminally. The complaint against her describes that Brian was struck about his rib cage, back, and face with this belt and with this electrical cord. If we look at the multi-generational dysfunction and the multi-generational violence that was going on in Brian's family, his mother's home was physically abusive. So,
Prosecutor O'Brien said that troubling life experiences are prevalent in society, yet these people don't go on to commit aggravated robberies, rapes, and kidnappings, and don't go on to murder people. He further said that he didn't believe that Brian's apology was genuine. He said that Brian was capable of making his own decisions, such as kidnapping, raping, robbing, and murdering Reagan. He told the jury that the only appropriate sentence was death. It was now up to the jury to recommend Brian's fate. They could either recommend one or three life sentences, or the death penalty on four different counts of aggravated murder. If they could not unanimously agree on the death penalty, the jury would be required to recommend life in prison without the opportunity of parole. The jury would deadlock on 8-4 on the question of whether Brian should be sentenced to death. Ultimately, the jury returned with a unanimous verdict of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Common Pleas Judge Mark Serrett then added two more for the kidnapping and rape. When handing down the sentence, the judge said,
"You get spared because of your background, and yet she forfeited her life. She did nothing wrong except be at work."
Following the verdict, Reagan's mother, Lisa, was given the opportunity to speak.
"Regardless of the outcome of today's verdict, it doesn't bring our daughter back. It doesn't erase the night of terror that Reagan had to endure. It doesn't erase the graphic details and images that are forever burned into our minds."
The following month, Brian pleaded guilty to 6 armed robberies that took place before Reagan's murder. He was sentenced to an additional 66 years. Reagan's family would file a lawsuit against the Ohio Adult Parole Authority and its contractors, stating that they should have known that Brian was a danger. The judge would throw the lawsuit out, stating that the state had no special relationship with Reagan to protect her from Brian. He also found that since Brian had been released from prison and was not on parole, the department did not have an obligation to confine him. In December, part of the Reagan-Tokes Act was signed into law. This allowed prison terms to be shortened or lengthened depending on an inmate's behaviour. First and second degree felons could have their sentences increased by up to 50% if they cause trouble while behind bars.
It's just, you know, devastating as parents. You never get over it. It never goes away for us or any other member of our family. It's always there. It's always with you.
What was taken away from us, something positive had to come from it. And God finds ways to do good in all things, even evil.
There was no choice except we had to act immediately.
She just cared about everyone. It didn't matter who you were, where you came from, what you were like. She was always there for everyone.
She would want us doing this at this point. She would want us trying to make something positive from this terrible tragedy. She just had such a kind, loving spirit.
The abduction, rape, and murder of Reagan Tokes gave legitimacy to the collective fear that women worldwide share, that somebody could do them harm while doing something as simple as walking to their car at night. Her murder caused outrage because of the many systemic failures that led to it. Brian Goolsbee had a lengthy criminal record, but due to Ohio's truth in sentencing laws, he could not be kept in prison longer. Reagan's legacy is the Reagan-Tokes Act, and it's an act that will undoubtedly save lives by keeping violent and unrehabilitated inmates behind bars. It's just a shame that one of those couldn't be Reagan. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Jennifer Sleaf, Kelly Gabbard, Dawn Wilson, Velvet Dawn, Debbie Higgins, and Heathen's Mum. I now have Morbidology merch, which is exclusive to Patreon, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, and fridge magnets. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, and the support on Patreon seriously helps so much. As well as the merch, if you join on Patreon, you'll also get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, early release episodes, ad-free episodes, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There are no obligations, and you can cancel at any time. You can also sign up annually and get 15% off. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, followed me on social media. All of the support is very much appreciated. Can I ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing True Crime Podcast, our True Crime Podcast. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
This is Edward October. Sunday morning, and I'm here at a typical American home. But inside, Jen and Cam of our True Crime Podcast sit down to record their latest episode. Though Jen and Cam are lifelong friends, they approach true crime with the utmost professionalism. Their focus?
So, what do you?
Highly articulate.
Alachua? Is that how you say it?
Alachua, like Joshua, but Alachua. You will Alachua onto my...
And above all, compassionate.
Honestly, I debated if I wanted to do this. And in the end, I decided it was important to honor this baby's short life.
Every day, more folks wake up hungry for a true crime podcast. And our true crime podcast is enjoyed best by more people. So whenever you're downloading any podcast of any kind, be sure to download an extra episode of our True Crime Podcast. You'll like them. Available on all your favorite podcatchers or at ourtruecrimepodcast.com.
See this? The mouth? It gets me in trouble.